Welcome to Real Talk. This is a program about anything that piques my interest. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and your interest, dear listener. Please send your questions to realtalk@voiceofvashon.org, and I'll find an expert to answer them. The question today is broad and specific at the same time. The question is, how does one make life work in the face of challenges? And the expert who has joined me today and has managed to pull this off is Amanda Kelly. Amanda is an entrepreneur, a poet, a yogi, and a mother of five. Welcome, Amanda.
Thank you so much. I'm so delighted to be here.
It's really great to have you. And this was a slightly unusual start to a Real Talk show.
I feel like that's the start of all my stories.
Okay. The start was just a conversation in a bar. And I was fascinated to learn how you have managed to make a really stellar life in the face of some great adversity. So let's start with, how was your life before you started figuring it out as well as you have now?
So I feel like, you know, a lot of times people say, and we'll get into more of the backstory, I think, throughout this conversation, but I always ask, like, what was the big pivot point? And for me, there were a couple big pivot points. One was when I had the triplets, who are now 21. And then at one point, I had five children under six. And the next was in 2009, when I nearly died of a really severe infection. Those are big pivot points. But for me, more the challenge and the gift is, I feel like I make it work in the smaller daily incremental challenges of being in the world. And when I was a little kid, so you asked the sort of foundational story, I was never a child that was completely comfortable in my own skin. I mean, I have journals going back to as soon as I could write, you know, 6, 7 years old, that were lists of things I would change about myself. If only so-and-so would like me, if I brought more gum to school, if I had different shoes. I mean, just ridiculous stuff, right? And I look back now and I think that is a sad way for a child to feel.
Yeah.
But I kind of was uncomfortable in my own skin and experimented with substances and all those things throughout high school and college because they were kind of shortcuts to feeling okay in my own skin, I think. None work for long.
I don't think that's an uncommon story for a young person growing up in this culture, especially a young woman.
Yeah, we moved around a lot. I mean, I lived in three countries, I think, before I was nine. And I had a loving home. My parents were amazing and it was a super solid. I mean, if there is such a thing as a white picket fence house, we were a little bit that. My mom stayed home. My dad worked. They were lovely. But it was inside me. It came from inside, right? This sort of feeling of discontentedness and always worry, always anxiety about the next thing that was going to happen.
Why can't I make it? Why am I not acceptable to myself? Were those the questions that went
kind
on
of
in your
head? I mean, I was a straight A student, had enough friends, had a loving family, right? And still there was this little thing inside that was not, that felt like that was all the shell, and there was still something missing, always.
Something that wasn't good
enough.
Yeah,
and I got little hints of what felt right to me that made me feel better in the world. I remember we went, I was a huge reader when I was a little girl, and we went to visit Walden Pond and Louisa May Alcott's house in the same day. I think my parents, we were living in Massachusetts at the time, and I remember buying all the Little Women books and everything else she'd written and everything from that day and bringing it home and reading it. And I remember thinking this. I was sitting on a big rock in my backyard. Oh, this is what I want to do. Like just completely at home with that day and how I felt and falling in love with this language and reading. And I knew like there were little signposts of things that made me feel okay, even if a friend was mad at me at school, even if I felt like I didn't have the right dress on.
You know, there are some really wise people who say that our purpose in life is to figure out who we are and why we're here. And one of the best ways to do that is to remember that blissful child, those moments in childhood when you were at your most blissful.
Yep,
and
absolutely.
What were you doing and how were you lost in that? When you were lost and didn't care whether you were good enough or whether anyone else accepted you. So was it that, the moment when you felt that writing was the thing you wanted to do?
That or writing or language or something around that, just that connection to that. Uh-huh. I got it. I mean, I always, when I was riding horses, I used to ride competitively and I would have that at times. I was never particularly athletic. We used to have these torturous events once a year. It was the Presidential Fitness Awards.
Oh, yes, I remember
that. Literally my worst nightmare. Like having to run with every single kid in my class and be graded on it. And, you know, I would always cheat on the answers of how many sit-ups I did, which is funny because I can probably do more than that now. But back then, it was all that external stuff that I was hoping would validate me, but really, in some deeply intuitive way, I knew it was the internal stuff that was making me more comfortable in the world.
So we've titled this conversation, Making It Work.
We have.
What does that mean to you?
Making it work is finding a way through the world where you're contented and feel like it's enough. Like, I am enough is a beautiful, powerful thing to be able to say in the world. And I know so many women that I work with and friends that I have, and everybody's questioning, like they have so much and it's just not a deep-seated feeling of fullness in what they have and what's available. And I feel like for me, that journey's been iterative. Like there are lots of things I don't have right now. When I was married, I had, you know, a big house on Capitol Hill in Seattle and really good health insurance and a new car if I wanted them and all those things. And I have health insurance and a house and a car now, but it doesn't look the same. But I'm so much better in it. So I think making it work is finding a way to navigate to a place where your life feels good to you. Like it's not a bad thing to have a life that fits you and who you are. And so I think part of my role in the world, the work that I do professionally and, you know, conversations I have with people and doing this work with you and writing and raising my kids is it's enough. Whatever you're doing, just try and take the next step forward because you never know what lies beyond that. And then it's okay to not have the answer right when you start. Like all my friends that, you know, we told this so often, like you have to find your passion and do that one thing. I'm like, well, that's great. And right now I have a full-time job managing a international online wellness platform. And I run one of the biggest social media accounts in this industry that I'm in. And those are blissful, joyful things. But my first 20 years of having a career, I wrote boring press releases for health insurance companies, right? Like you have to realize it's a process and that making it work also looks like, please don't look in the backseat of my car. People are like, oh my God, you do these amazing things and you have five kids and they're in college and you're doing this and you're doing that. I'm like, I literally have not vacuumed my car in 2 years. Like unless one of my kids steps up and gives me a coupon for Mother's Day, it doesn't happen. So, but I'm okay with that. And there was a time when it was more about what it looked like when people got in my car than that I'd had an hour to write that morning, right? So finding the ability to just make those simple choices for yourself, whatever that looks like.
Was there something about going through those previous career moves, like writing boring press releases or whatever else you might have done, and I don't know all that, that gave you insight into pieces of what you did in each of those places?
Yeah, so I went to college in on a four-year poetry writing scholarship. So
wow.
You can imagine how employable I was when I got out of there, right? But then started working in a bookstore in a little New England town that I lived in and loved that job because I got to read everything for free and have conversations about books all day. It was never going to be enough money to really, truly, you know, buy a house or anything, but it was a perfect job. It was a good stepping stone and wound up writing some small blurbs, you know, for local papers. And it was the writing work and the conversations about book pieces that I really liked to do. And then I think it's always been for me, you know, you get a whole box of pebbles, but there's one that's shiny, like picking up that shiny pebble in the uh-huh. thing and then moving on to the next thing.
I think that's a really valuable piece of information for people because folks, particularly very talented folks who have a lot of gifts, for one thing, have trouble narrowing down to one gift that they want to use the most. And also are impatient with the steps that they have to go through. Sometimes you just got to do the crummy work and or what might appear to be crummy work. But if you look closely, you're getting something out of it.
Well, and I feel like that's where the yoga piece comes in. So we've kind of skipped over that piece of it. When I got really, I nearly died in 2009. I was in ICU for 8 weeks. I got last rites, the whole thing. Everybody was ready to say goodbye. You know that, it was that flesh eating bacteria, but I got it on my chest wall.
Yeah.
So I was at Swedish Hospital for a long time and literally nearly died. But that was, it was a huge freedom. It was a huge freedom coming out of that because I realized that, first of all, I was never scared, even when I was unconscious
you
and kind
not.
Of coming to. It never felt like a bad thing to pass. Like, I didn't see a shining white light. You know, there was no beacon in the sky, but also I was unafraid, like truly unafraid. And I remember being really conscious of that. But also coming out of that, I had a year that was very bleak. And I think it's because I had lost, you know, some wages. I was self-employed and hadn't worked for a while. So I was scrapping for money. I was in a horrible love affair that was really painful. I think the reality of being divorced and providing for all these kids was really settling. It was a dark time. So I told myself
that
I was going to do...
a huge burden.
It was hard. It was hard. And I felt bleak in the world, which is not my ordinary... Not all the time, right? And I didn't think I needed to be treated for depression. It felt in my core situational. So I said, I'm going to pick one new thing once a month and do it. So maybe it's not wear black every day. Like literally, all my work clothes were black for like 6 years. And then... One month, it was like, I'm going to go back and start taking yoga classes, even if I can only get there once a week, because I had done it before when I was pregnant and really liked it and always thought, oh, someday I'll try. So I started going to a little studio near one of my client offices and just fell in love with the practice. And that for me, just saying the practice sounds really yogi and weird, but what it means is, for me, the big translation of why yoga works as a philosophy for so many people is the asana, the physical practice, is only a small piece of the whole yogic philosophy, but it's being comfortable with discomfort. I mean, that is why yogis, when they established this, folded their bodies all those ways, right? It's because you stay in it and breathe through it regardless of how you think and feel. And that is a huge lesson.
True. And you get past it.
You get past it.
Yes.
And it's right behavior, right? I mean, all those things. But you can learn to be uncomfortable in a thing and do it anyway. Right. So all those years of work that wasn't terribly exciting, I knew I was getting skills and I was getting paid, and doing work and providing for yourself is a really big deal. To be able to take care of yourself in this world is huge. And even if you can't, because you can't, you're not employable, whatever, like doing something, even if it doesn't necessarily, you know, I don't rise out of bed to go run in the forest every morning, like super excited about it when it's pouring with rain and I've been up all night. But I do it anyway because I've learned the benefit of practice. And I think writing is one of those things. Like, you get to be a better writer if you practice. You become a better musician if you practice. You can't just step on the stage with your guitar after two lessons and get into that flow, right? So the practice brings you to the magic, not the magic makes you practice. That's not that easy.
That's great.
The magic. It'd be nice, but
the practice brings you to the magic. We're talking with Amanda Kelly on Real Talk about making it work, and she is someone who has done so through a variety of adversities. And we are here in large part because of support from the Hardware Store Restaurant, serving great good food, free Wi-Fi, and signature cocktails in an historic 125-year-old building, the heartbeat of Vashon Island. And speaking of heartbeats, you've been talking about how it was before you got to the point of being able to make your life work. And you mentioned a few pivot points. So where is your life now? What are you doing now? And how has your past informed that? How have your experiences informed that?
So right now I'm working full time for an organization that I love very much, where I get to run a entire web universe about yoga and wellness and healing, mostly from Vashon. Sometimes I have to travel. And I have one child who's graduating in 1 week, and a freshman, and then three children in university. But my internal world, which I think is what this conversation is mostly yes. about, is I wake up really excited every day to be in this place and in this extraordinary world and grateful.
So how did you get there?
But here's the thing. And people always say, well, you're so lucky. But also, I get stressed out in traffic. Also, I get impatient in the Fauntleroy line. Also, I'm like, God, there's no food in the fridge and I just do not have the energy to go Thriftway, or how much money have I spent on First Friday this week, right? That chatter of just trying to rip yourself off from the pleasures of your own life is constant, I think, for everybody. I'm not so blissed out all the time that I'm happy to once again be vacuuming my dog's hair off the couch, right? It's not that. I mean, I feel like there's real struggles. I work really hard when I work. When I have friends calling and I can't answer and things I would rather be doing than sending 1,000 emails. But the trend is in a direction where I feel like my life fits, like in my solar plexus. So when I think when you get to that place, even if there are challenges or difficulties, it just feels better at like a cellular level than struggling to do something that you know in your mind is not a right fit.
Is there some element there of taking control of your life.
Yeah, and being willing to take the hits, right? I mean, I could be working for a lot more money downtown and leaving the island every day and going in and not being excited about the work that I do. But I think you have to decide in your life, and I'm not saying that my life would be a perfect fit for everybody, in your life, what truly matters versus what do you think you should be doing? It's that question of expectation versus contentedness.
Expectations. So how are your expectations different now from when, say, you were working in big
I think my expectations now are more about my ability to feel free in the world, to make my own choices and not have to necessarily live in a way that feels like I'm in a box of some kind. And I mean, I'm not saying that in any way because I'm divorced now and I was married before. No, I mean, that's part of it. But when you're married and it's a conscious decision to share your life and do those things with somebody, I just think I don't do anything now that feels inauthentic to who I actually am. I kind of walk my talk and do those things. And before, a lot of it felt like trying on costumes and then discarding them, you know? Now I'm going to have a perfect Martha Stewart Christmas, and then I'm going to have a perfect job, and then I'm going to have a perfectly clean house while I'm raising little kids, or those things, right? Like, it's all what I thought I should be wanting and doing versus what actually was fulfilling.
So where do you think those expectations came from? You were married at the time. How much did marriage have to do with it, or how much did what you thought the world would call success have to do with it?
That is a really good question. I mean, I think a little of both, right? We kind of are given feeders our whole lives about what we think things should look like. I mean, there was a time when I was following the dead around the country and I thought my adult life was going to look really different. I'd be playing, you know, the violin in some band in a commune somewhere, and that was going to be the definition of what I turned out to be. And other times when I was going to be in Manhattan and working at a publishing house. I mean, I think those things shift, but for me, I never realized I could get to this place of contentedness in my own skin. So I think that has shifted all my expectations. Because now the external things matter less than knowing how I have gotten here and wanting to hold on to that for dear life. Because it literally is for dear life. Like, I love my life.
What I'm hearing is, at least somewhat, is a letting go of the world's external idea of true success, like the big job, the one that the publishing house
right.
in Manhattan,
but I
or
feel like
the
first
big
step
thing.
Of it is defining what success is for you, and you get that through those small nuanced decisions about knowing where you actually can find your joy and purpose.
But don't you have to back up even farther from the idea of success being income or position or title to success is what makes me feel right inside.
It is what makes me feel right inside. And I mean, this is finite, right? The older I get, I'll be 49 this year. The older I get, the more I realize, like, this is passing by. At some point, I've probably passed my halfway mark, right?
Yeah.
I mean, unless medicine gets even better or we get really great health insurance in the US, something. But so when you realize like the days are numbered, I feel like it's easier to start really paying attention to how you're spending them. I mean, it's not the job of a 15-year-old to worry about like, what am I going to be doing when I'm 65? But for me, it kind of is. And I think knowing that something is finite makes you treasure it more and be more careful with it. So now, I mean, one of the things I've gotten really good at is saying no. If I don't want to do a thing, I don't mean about work or, you know, responsibilities
anything.
You have to meet, but choices that are actual choices, like you don't have to do everything you're invited to do. And you get to say, like sometimes sitting alone at home reading a book makes me as happy as anything.
So obviously this isn't a message that you got as a teenager, or if it was given to you,
no, but
it wasn't
you get it
soaking
in pieces, right? So I feel like the older and maybe wiser you become, then you realize, I mean, I feel like none of this is news, right? There are huge philosophies that talk about this stuff and being comfortable in your own skin and being of some service in the world, whatever your gifts are, sharing them. I mean, I remember reading Mary Oliver when I was in college, and just that, you know, that question that's always asked, what is it you want to do with your one wild and precious life? That's huge. And I laugh because last year, one of my sons who's in college now is like, we read a poem you'd really love. I was like, I love that poem. But
so how do you talk to your kids now when you talk about choices that they can make or how they might shape their future? You know, what do you say to them that might be different from what your parents said or what you heard in your head at that point in your life?
It's interesting. I feel like my my kids are amazing, but they are literally who they were born to be. And actually having the triplets is a really good example of how your essential nature is who you're born. I mean, they were born within a minute of each other. And they have these three kids. And my daughter was like, ah, bring on the world. And one kid was just checking it all out and being very Buddha-like. And one was a little anxious. And that's who they've remained, right? So you're kind of born who you are. And they had the same food and went to the bathroom at the same time and slept at the same time and have gone off in totally different directions. And my child who's graduating now, is his entire life has just been exactly who he is. And I think the best thing I've done for my kids, and it's not always easy, is to try and, first of all, parent them and not be their friend. Mm-hmm. So certain expectations, you will meet them, right? Part of the practice is drudgery. And the other stuff is to pay attention to who they actually are. I mean, they know. My child who is graduating now has always been really good at fixing things. And he's not going off to get a humanities degree because it's not a fit for him. He's going to go build things and do great things that way, right? You don't all have to be the same thing. The outcome is not the same. Right. Your contented life is not my contented life.
I love what you said about drudgery, because I think there's a philosophy, the have a nice day and it's all good philosophy in this culture that says happiness is about happy, happy, happy all the time.
It's not
I'll never be uncomfortable or I'll never have to work when what I'm hearing you say is part of using your juice and growing your best is actually working, doing that stuff that is that four-letter word work that really isn't all that bad.
It's not all that bad. It's much, I mean, I always think the anticipation of things is worse than the actual doing of them. Yeah. People are always like, why do you get up early and start working? I was like, well, I like to get up early. It's my natural thing. But I like getting in it and doing it. Once you're there, it's sitting around dreading it. I think that's the harder part psychologically. And if there's something you really want, like working towards it isn't a hardship. It feels really good.
Moving toward it feels so much better than procrastinating.
Right, it's little things. One example that just comes to my mind is people always saying, how do I get a meditation practice? Like, I don't know how to do that. What do I do? And I'm like, you literally, it's super easy. Find a song that you like that moves you some way and try and make it like a 3-minute song, because that's all you'll be able to do at first. And just sit there and listen to that and pay attention to your breath. No matter what you think, you have 3 minutes a day, right? Make it a practice though, because you'll never get it if you are like, oh, I can't be bothered today. Just do the thing. And it can be a really small, small thing, but doing the work helps. And I think it helps the universe, and this is going to sound really woo-woo, but it does help. The universe has to meet you halfway. You can't say, I want to be a famous writer and never write anything. Like, you have to submit something possibly, or you can't perform in a show if you don't ever find a band to play with. I mean, you have to do the work and meet it. But that's where the joy is, I think.
And it doesn't have to be Hollywood, and it doesn't have to be paid. It doesn't have to be the best band out there.
It doesn't. And you can work a job you despise, but if you have to, I feel like people that are healthiest and most at home in themselves have something they do that brings them great joy, and they already know what it is. So it's figuring out a way to make room for that, whatever it looks like. And I get it, right? People are working 2 jobs to pay for their kids to go to school, or they have real health issues, and or they're going through a, you know, some kind of horrible legal problem or something. I mean, things that are really oppressive and difficult to do. But I think even in those times, if you can carve out some room for what feels like where you want to be, it'll bless the whole rest of it.
Let's talk a little more about that, because I think some of the folks who are going to appreciate this conversation the most are single mothers, and they might be single mothers of young kids. What would you say to a woman who is listening to us who might be a single mom with 3 kids recently out of a marriage?
Yeah, I mean, I totally get that. That is a hard place to be. I mean, at one point I had 5 kids under 6, and I think my youngest was 5 and my eldest were 11 when I got separated. And so I had them by myself and was doing the work. I think in those days I was trying to start a business and I was raising these kids, and their dad's awesome, and but, you know, he wasn't there all the time. And I think there were times when I thought, there's no way I can do this, but still got out of bed in the morning and tried to do it. And now the end is here. But I do remember even then thinking, like, at 8 o'clock at night, I had nothing left. Like, there was no juice left. I couldn't play another game of anything or find one more soccer cleat or cook one more meal and being like, hey, it's reading time, because I wanted to read. So I didn't care what they looked at, but it couldn't be a screen and they couldn't ask me any questions, right? So just like sitting on the ground for 20 minutes, all of us reading, because I was desperate to get back into whatever book is a little departure. And the little kids could flip through something and the older ones could read to them if they wanted to. But it was just like that was all I had for like a year of what I really wanted to do, right? But it was something and it was mine.
It sounds like creating a ritual for refreshment.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think when you say stuff like that, then people think, oh, it means I have to get into my bathtub and have perfect candles. And I can't get into my bathtub because I have one at my house and two teenage sons. So if I want to get in it, I have to scrub it first. So I just give up. I only take baths in hotels now till they're all graduated. Yeah, I think it's, you know, maybe if it's playing a song you like or taking the time to step out on your back porch and look at the moon. I mean, just whatever your thing is, I don't know, because everybody's so different. I'm not a cook, but I know that there are people that get like huge pleasure out of ingredients and cooking and taking the time and having a glass of wine. Like, do that for yourself, even if you're busy. Or if it's writing or music, just, or if you've always wanted to learn to play the guitar, watch a YouTube video and borrow a guitar. We have a instrument library on Vashon. You could do it that way.
That's
it doesn't
right.
have to cost money. None of this stuff has to cost money. That's another thing too. It's not like I'm talking about you have to reinvent the whole wheel. It's just like one step on a ladder at a time.
So maybe just think about what it is you really like to do.
Just pick one thing that brings you joy. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is. It can be anything.
And that can help you, single moms and single dads, and
yeah.
all the folks who are out there carrying two jobs or raising kids.
Yeah,
or,
I mean, it's a tough, tough world.
Yeah, it is.
You do
tough
have
world.
To fill the well, though, somehow. You have to refill your personal well. And I think it has to come from what you need to refill that well comes from inside you. Like if you really just shut your eyes and like put your hand on your belly and think about the last time you felt like you were out of mind and into your body and soul, like what was that? And it can be anything.
Amanda Kelly, I want to thank you so much
it's
for the
pleasure.
Time.
I love the voice of Vashon.
Thank you. You've given us a half hour of your precious time and a lot of your ebullient energy and a lot of candor and help for anybody out there who's wondering, how the heck am I going to make it to the next day? How the heck am I going to make it work? Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Clearly,
my pleasure.
You're doing it. Stay with me now for a little real talk dessert. It's Lyons on Literature with Mary Fran Lyons, who brings us information, insight from the books that she reads. This one is The Warmth of Other Suns. Welcome, Mary Fran.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
So this book is a little different from your others.
It's a little different from the others. Anyone that's listened to the first two episodes knows that I'm very interested in the whole issue of slavery and the place that it plays in our history and the real people who were involved. And so this book is called The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson, and the subtitle is The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. And Isabel Wilkerson is a woman of color, and she did this very large study. I want to say 1,200 people. I mean, a lot.
Wow.
Where she did extensive interviews and other things to find out where they had been in their life, why they went, where they went, these kinds of things. And she quotes from some of that in the book, but then she picked three people that she thought were particularly representative of that whole episode where blacks pretty much moved north for jobs and to have better lives. And she took three of those people and followed them in minute detail with extensive interviews and talking about their lives in great detail. And that is what this book is about. And it is a long book, but I will tell you, I could not put it down. I think I read it in 2 days. I was just totally riveted by the stories that these people had. And I would say that their stories are riveting and extraordinary in how amazing the things were that happened to them. But in so many ways, what happened to them was very ordinary things. They're things that the rest of us don't even know about with respect to attitudes about black people and things like that. Okay, you hear about Jim Crow, you hear about this, you hear about the other. But to have it spelled out chapter and verse, the impact that it had on these people, why they decided they had to go somewhere else, what drove them, what it was like, is really very, very powerful. And I couldn't put it down.
Can you give us some examples of, it sounds like it was institutional racism that they had to overcome in one way or another. Can you give us an example or two?
Yeah. One of the people in the book that she chronicles in some detail is someone who lived in Florida. And in Florida, it was sort of the next generation of slavery, where you work very hard for very low wages. And so the blacks in that instance would be picking oranges and things like that, and very oppressed. And they even, you know, they tried to go on strike. They could not go on strike. They could be threatened with violence if they were going on strike, this sort of thing. And so people would finally have enough and say, okay, I'm going to leave. But the whites didn't want them to leave because here goes their, you know,
cheap labor
force. And so they would be threatened with violence if they left. And so they would have to sneak out of town under cover of night, like thieves with their own lives to go somewhere else to, I mean, you're reading this and it's just like, wow, this is the United States of America that we're talking about. It's the kind of thing that that has such impact just on, you know, the entire arc of a person's life, that I think hearing about it, you know, in the abstract is just not as dramatic as reading one person's account of that. Another person in the book that she chronicles is a physician, and it's some of the things that he went through in terms of how he had to practice and the circumstances of his practicing and things like that, that, you know, were hugely impacted by his race and what it led, decisions that led him to make and where he would go and that sort of thing. So very, very specific individuals that through her writing, you know, you've come to know quite well as human beings. And so your appreciation for it is a whole lot more than if you just, you know, hear a recounting of somebody had something bad happen to them. These are people you care about based on her writing.
The best way to illustrate an issue is to tell an individual story. How does institutional racism or other sorts of global or institutional attitudes truly affect a human being and their life, and it carries them through their lives, stays with them.
Absolutely. So when I read this book, it was so powerful for me that I wrote to Isabel Wilkerson and told her I was doing this. And I went out and bought, I have a very large family, I went out and bought 12 hardcover copies. And you pay top dollar for that, of course. And I sent one to every member of my family. And I said, you need to read this book because it brings home what people have been living through.
What kind of feedback did you get from your family after you did that?
I think one or two of them might have read it.
And the others went, oh my gosh, that's a big book.
Probably. And, you know, I have this thing where if I read a book that I love and that I think really has a message, I will get multiple copies and then I give them to people and I say, read it and give it to somebody else. It's like my version of a little circulating library. My mother says, whenever I send her a book to read, she knows it's worth reading because I've pre-screened it. So, you know, she usually will. But so it's my little way of trying to affect the world by things that have really resonated for me.
Well, and we appreciate these book recommendations on Lions on Literature here on Real Talk. This is another way for you to spread your interest in reading. Thank you, Mary Fran.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Real Talk, and Real Talk is made possible through the generosity of Windermere Vashon, who supports all our community information programming here on the Voice of Vashon.